This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 13, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, theatrical performance artist and author, Antaro Ali, as well as a trilogue with multimedia artist and author, Jason Horsley. Joining me this week as co-host is fashion designer Misty Greer. On this episode, both guests bring us back to the theme of mind-body and how our physical lives are tethered to the deepest parts of our mental landscapes. In exploring some of the deeper questions surrounding personal identity and consciousness, each has drawn on and synthesized points of interest from psychology, art, and kinesthetic practice. I think you'll find the unique frameworks they've constructed to be useful maps, or psychocosms, as I like to say, for navigating one's own self-development process. Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. I've only read your Eight Circuit Brain book, and I haven't done any of the practice, but I did appreciate it on a lot of levels. Like, I definitely agreed that in reading Wilson and Leary, it is a lot of theory, and I love that because I'm of the same mind, and I could never get enough of it. But the fact that you've kind of reincorporated, like, a practice to go side by side with it, as far as your experience goes and what your art form is, I think it's really super useful. Even though I haven't done it yet, I can just see the value of it and the utility of it.
Yeah, thanks for that. At first, when I first began advancing Leary's and Wilson's treatment of the Eight Circuit Brain Model into a more or less personal application of it, I honestly assumed that it was just going to be personal to me, and I didn't even really plan on publishing a book or making a book of it. I just, you know, wanted to go through these circuits on a first-hand, direct experience basis to see if I could do it. One thing led to another, and this is now, oh gosh, over 30 years later, and the kind of wonderful revelation that has come over the last 10 years, as I've been teaching an online course in the Eight Circuit Model to, by now, about 500 or 600 people have come through this process, and it turns out that the model that I presented in Angel Tech and my more recent book, The Eight Circuit Brain, is not just personal to me. It turns out that, you know, it's been applied, well, at least at this point, by hundreds of other people to good effect.
I'm definitely interested in getting into that. And before we get really rolling, though, I will get an introduction here. So joining me today on Pentimental is Antaro Ali. Antaro is the author of Angel Tech and The Eight Circuit Brain, to name only a couple of his many books. He's also a practitioner and teacher of paratheatrics. Beside this, Antaro has produced several feature-length art films inspired by his paratheatrical no-form praxis. So, Antaro, thank you for being with me today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
We already jumped in a little bit into this concept of the Eight Circuit Brain, and we will discuss that more. But can you go a bit more into detail about your history and how you developed into a performer and writer specifically?
Okay, well, it's a long, winding story, and I'll give you the really short, edited version of it. So I'm in my early 60s now, and I've been active in the process of writing, directing, performing in theater, paratheater, and various forms of visual media pretty much since I was a teenager. So I started really early. And I think in terms of like why I did it, how I got into it, I keep coming back to this idea that it was just out of, you know, sheer terror that if I didn't find some way to give expression to the feelings and the images and the thoughts and the experiences that I had on an internal level, in terms of, I'm basically an introvert. If I didn't find ways to make the unconscious conscious, bring what's inside of me out of me so other people can relate to it, so I can relate to other people. I would have probably just turned into a basket case or in prison or in a hospital or dead or something. So it really came out of a sense of urgency of really needing to find ways to give expression to the internal landscape of my dreams, my feelings, my thoughts, beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. Again, the revelation from that over the years has taken some time. At first, it became a very subjective and personal process, but the more I committed to the more subjective experiences I underwent, at some point it broke into some more objectivity when it turned out that other people could start relating and telling me about their experiences and how they resonated with what I went through or what I felt or saw or whatever. And so it's been a really interesting journey from deep subjectivity to earning a little objectivity along the way.
What inspired you to get into writing? And specifically Angel Tech, I guess, was the first enterprise, but what's motivated you before that and since then?
Well, it's pretty much the same thing. Writing is a dark art. You know, you do it alone. You can only really write if you're willing to spend at least 3 hours alone in a room, either with a pad and pencil or a computer or whatever, but it's a solitary task. And for me, writing has in some ways always been an effective way to organize my ideas, get more clear on the things that matter to me, finding articulations of some ineffable weird experience that I had, and all of a sudden I'm able to put it into words, and oh my God, I'm actually communicating with other people. Other people are responding to my words and so forth. So it becomes this ongoing process of excavation of personal experience and the transformation of that process into real communication. So communication, the need to communicate for me has been probably the biggest reason why I got into writing and why I still write.
So the focus of Angel Tech and the Eighth Circuit Brain is just that, the Eighth Circuit model of consciousness. And this was, I guess, most developed by Leary, Timothy Leary. And that came from some mysterious source, which maybe you can embellish on. And Timothy Leary developed this model of how the nervous system operates, and there's eight levels to it. And this borrows from the chakra system, as far as my understanding goes. And then Robert Anton Wilson, who I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, took this up and developed it even further, and then Ontario took it up in Angel Tech, which I think was in 85?
Yeah, it first came Angel Tech 85, 86, 87, around there. It went through a number of different editions. Yeah, the mysterious source of the Eighth Circuit Brain emerged in the early 60s in Timothy Leary's Millbrook days. Millbrook is this large estate on the East Coast. I forgot what state it's in. And he was paid a visit by this Rutgers scholar of Sanskrit and Hindu studies that was only referred to as Professor Adams. And this is documented in the preface of Leary's early book, What Does Woman Want? So people can, you know, check into it there. And this Professor Adams and Leary walked around Millbrook Estates day after day. Nobody else, they did it alone. They were just between the two of them. And Leary apparently absorbed an oral tradition of the esoteric chakra system, which is very different from the chakra system that you read in like New Age books or the Americanization of, you know, the chakras or whatever. And so he was, I think, very impressed by not just the potential of these energy centers in the human body, but because of his background as not just a psychiatrist, but also a scientific thinking psychiatrist, he decided to upgrade or advance the terminology instead of chakras or energy centers. He simply called them circuits, because even back then, he foresaw the future of the computer technology and the cyber industry. So in that way, he was kind of ahead of his time. And Leary was a theorist. One of his nicknames in Harvard was Theory Leary, because he was just one of these individuals that produced reams and reams of theories. And Robert Anton Wilson in the early 80s, he was a friend of Leary's, and his contribution was connecting the Eighth Circuit Brain to multiple systems theories. So he was linking it up to quantum physics, he was linking it up to political science, he was linking it up to sociology and semantics and so forth. And then when I was first exposed to the Eighth Circuit Brain, it was through the Wilson's book, Cosmic Trigger. And that came out in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, and I was just blown away by a little section in the book that outlined a very brief synopsis of the eight circuits, and I decided, wow, I would like to experience these circuits firsthand. I don't want to just read about them or read about other people's ideas about them. I'd like some firsthand experience. And so I spent the next 3 or 4 years from my theater background developing certain exercises, rituals, meditations that brought me into a closer proximity to some experience of the energies, the states of consciousness, the forces inherent, or let's say symbolized by the eight circuits. Because the circuits, basically, they're just, it's a symbolic system. You know, there's no circuits in the body. It's just a way of referring to human experience. And so I became fascinated with finding ways to trigger, invoke, or evoke the direct experience of the energies and forces of the very states of consciousness that the circuits symbolized.
I think you refer to these as shocks, is that correct?
I use the term shocks to refer to some of the upper circuit activations. Specifically, shocks, as I'm referring to them, they're not negative or positive. A lot of times people have the idea of shock being like a traumatic or negative thing, and sometimes they can be traumatic, but sometimes also traumas and shocks can produce very positive, productive, and even creative results. And the particular shocks I'm referring to here is the shock of rapture, which is a circuit 5 shock. Rapture, ecstasy, you know, when a person enters into a, you know, full-blown state of rapture or ecstasy. You know, they're, in a sense, in a state that's beyond ordinary consciousness at that point. And then the circuit 6 shock would correlate to the shock of uncertainty. You know, when we enter those situations in life, I'm talking about, you know, real life experiences where our experience of uncertainty escalates. And that typically is accompanied by anxiety, because everybody has their own threshold for how much uncertainty they can permit before turning into nervous monkeys. And so part of that 6th circuit shock of uncertainty comes with the responsibility for managing your anxiety. So you can work with the state of uncertainty really as a creative state. And circuit 7 shocks are the shocks of indivisibility. And that comes along, this can happen spontaneously, it can happen through ingestion of certain psychoactive drugs, it can happen through trauma, through great losses. But it results in an experience of indivisibility, where you have these moments where there's no separation between you or anything else, no separation between yourself and all living things. And so you come into this kind of shock of unity, and it really is a shock to the intellect. And a lot of times this can be a very frightening event to especially individuals who are more, let's say, intellectually identified. They're identified as intellects, and as we know, you know, intellect requires duality, you know, to function in its comparative associative mode. When you enter non-dualistic experiences where there's nothing to compare anything else with, it's a bit of a mind-blowing event. And so the more intellectually identified individuals would find this more frightening. And then those individuals who are not as intellectually identified can find great peace of mind and, you know, even a kind of deep happiness in knowing that, you know, they're part of everything else. It's not a paranoid scenario. And finally, last but not least, circuit 8 shocks are those shocks that bring about a much greater experience and awareness of impermanence. Oftentimes a devastating sense that what we thought was permanent or long-lasting or our one sure thing or whatever completely gets wiped away, and we're left with this sense of, oh my God, nothing is permanent. It's all impermanent. And again, those kinds of shocks can be quite startling and traumatic to individuals, but they also can, you know, shocks of impermanence can wise us up. We become less naive and a little more reality-based in our perceptions and not, you know, assume this, that, or the other thing is going to last forever. So, you know, the awareness of impermanence, for example, is one of the ongoing practices of Buddhism. And individuals who are practicing Buddhist processes are very aware of this, I would say, the creative, spiritual, and productive aspects of learning to live with more of an awareness of impermanence.
And there's sort of a harmonic relationship between the bottom circuits, the bottom four and the upper four, right? So you listed the top four, but then there's the more survival oriented circuits, one through four, which Wilson and Leary always sort of lampoon or try to paint as sort of something to be left behind, which I appreciate the romanticism of, but you sort of own these, you don't disown these more survival oriented centers, and you try to incorporate them, which I'm impressed by. So maybe you can talk about that.
That's a really great point. We have to remember that when Timothy Leary developed his eight circuit brain model, he was in prison most of that time. In fact, he was moving around from prison to prison. I think he had been moved around 20 or 30 times. He was assigned the status of a national security threat. Anyway, that informed his bias quite a bit. So his angle on the eighth circuit brain very much was biased by an ongoing desire, justifiably so, for escape. And so this reflected his fixation on space travel and getting off the planet. And you know, this is a kind of a, I think, philosophical extension of place he was actually in, which was, you know, moving around from prison to prison. He finally did escape. The funny story that comes along with his escape experience, and that is that he was put into a prison, and they gave him a test. They give prisoners tests to determine where to assign them in the prison. Are they going to go into maximum security, minimum security, medium security, whatever? So they gave Timothy Leary the test. What they didn't know at the time is that Timothy Leary actually wrote the test that he took. And so he knew exactly how to answer the test to put himself into minimum security, which is what happened. And he just bided his time until it was, you know, escape time, and he hightailed out, and that's when he went on his exile, hopping around from nation to nation in Europe and Africa, looking for a place to land, you know, where the government would welcome him. So it's quite an adventure there. And that's a bit of a sidetrack there, but it helps me understand the, you know, some of the, negative bias around the bottom four circuits. And I think Bob Wilson had a similar but different negative bias around the bottom four circuits, I think partly because of his lifelong struggle with polio. And, you know, he had a physical disability for most of his life, which he eventually succumbed to. It was the cause of his eventual death. Polio came back. It went away for a little while, not completely, because he always walked with a very stiff leg or a stiff gait. But he was not comfortable in his physical body throughout his life. So that was part of that. And so it's completely understandable, except that I felt that there was room to create a more, let's say, body positive approach to experiencing and understanding not just the eight circuits, but how the lower survival circuits, which are basically outlined. First circuit is your physical survival priorities. The second circuit is your emotional or territorial survival priorities. The third circuit is your intellectual or conceptual survival priorities. And then the fourth circuit is your social survival priorities. And so I have discovered, and I have not seen this in either of Leary's or Wilson's analysis of the circuit model, I discovered these correlations specifically between physical first circuit and circuit five, somatic intelligence, and the second circuit, the territorial emotional circuit, with circuit six, psychic intelligence, and then circuit three, symbolic or intellectual intelligence, and the seventh, or the mythopoetic or genetic intelligence, and then circuit four, the social moral intelligence function. That seems to serve as an anchor for the eighth circuit experiences, which are primarily out-of-body dream time events.
And somewhere synchronicity fits into the circuits, right? Is that seven?
I would say so, yeah. Yeah, each of the circuits branch out into a number of different attributes and types of experience that we undergo. And I think synchronicity, the experience of synchronicity definitely, I think, would fall into a seventh circuit event.
So there's this correspondence between the levels in the same sense as, say, you're developing your third circuit, which is your symbolic circuit. And in that sense, if you're making that as flexible as possible, and you get delivered a shock from, say, seven, which would challenge you creatively or challenge you in terms of meanings you've attached to certain things. So in that sense, the third kind of works as a buttress, depending on how flexible you are as like a thinker or something like that. Is that kind of one way to envision that relationship, the 3 and 7?
Yeah, I think you're really onto something there. My fourth book, it's called The Akashic Record Player. It's just now re-released by the original Falcon Press. That book actually was written for me to reclaim my sanity or my intellectual, conceptual intelligence after some really mind-blowing Circuit 7 events that occurred to me during the 80s. And so this would be an example. This was an example of my own life, how certain shocks of indivisibility and cosmic unity, you know, those events where you're at one with everything and it's kind of mind-blowing and a little bit crazy-making because it's a non-dualistic experience again, and the intellect is going, what the hell, what the fuck's going on here? So I decided that, you know, the only way that I could kind of, you know, get my mind back, because it was on the brink of losing touch with some ability to understand and communicate what was going on, that I had to sit down and write this book about, you know, what was happening. And of course, because I have an artistic bent or poetic sensibility, my experience was camouflaged through the creation of different characters and different events, all of them actually based on true story and real events that happened in my life during that time. But I wanted to also tell a good story. I think that's a big part of how to integrate Seventh Circuit shocks into a Third Circuit context, is to honor the more poetic and narrative interpretation of experience so that you don't get caught into over-literalization or over-analytical or over-trying to prove in an empirical way, because then it starts, you start cutting off to that Seventh Circuit source of inspiration that, again, by its very nature is non-dualistic. And if you can look to non-dualistic experiences as a source of inspiration, well, you know, you're ready to write poetry, you're ready to compose music, you're ready to find a language or a way of communicating some of these awe-inspiring experiences that we're capable of. A lot of famous composers, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, etc., I can only imagine that they had some kind of intellectual genius as a result of this interaction they've been able to develop between, you know, their Seventh Circuit experiences and their Third Circuit capacity to language those impressions, to put them into some kind of compositional form that can be shared with others. And this is, I think, partly why when you listen to Mozart or Beethoven or whatever classical music inspires you, it moves you. I mean, it can transport you into a Seventh Circuit event.
Just in my point of view from reading into occultism and what have you, however superficially I've done that, the essence I get from it is that it's always trying to tap into those, that level of genius, or what Jung would call the unconscious, or these sorts of things, that these are ceremonies, rituals. There's all sorts of ways to do it, through music, through psychedelics, through what you would term no form. I believe that's your practice, and maybe we'll get into that. Well, definitely get into that. But just the concept of tapping into that inner genius and inspiring people to find that in themselves at whatever level they manage to, I think is always the noble part of occultism, even though it gets a little silly sometimes. At the same time, that core for me is what makes it important. That's the appeal for me.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that, because I think it's a real key in tapping into why there's such a growing interest in experiences that move our awareness or consciousness beyond the mundane and banal boredom, the ennui of daily existence. I think something happened a few hundred years ago that created a kind of a tragic link to individuals of genius that hopefully we're outgrowing by now, and that was an error in judgment. And this error in judgment, I think, still occurs today, and it always, I think, results in tragedy of some kind. And the error in judgment is this mistaken identification of oneself as a genius. So to proclaim I am the genius, or think or assume that the genius is something of one's identity, like I am a genius or you're a genius, I think this is something that came out of the 1700s, 1600s, where that kind of language was more prevalent.
Mm.
And it still is to some extent, and it's unfortunate, because I think to the degree there is some kind of genius at work in an individual, I think once you attach your ego to that, it's going to almost immediately start to narrow the process of accessing that. It's going to start crimping the genius itself.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've discovered over the years is to just simply avoid any idea of becoming or identifying with genius, and instead setting up an interaction, a dialogue with the genius as an autonomous archetype, what used to be called in ancient Greek mythology the daemon, spelled D-A-E-M-O-N, the daemon. And in that interaction, and this is goes along in a sense with opening up to the higher circuits of this whole notion of interacting with an autonomous archetype, meaning some entity that has a life of its own, independent of your thinking, independent of any creation of your thought, you see. It's outrageous just to start with, because a lot of people assume that everything that they perceive or experience is simply a product of their minds. And for many, that's the truth. But there are individuals that awaken to a kind of second attention or a way of perceiving where they end up using the mind to see through the mind, using the mind to see past the mind or past the constructs of the mind. And I think that process there of what I'll call the second attention, which I'll explain in a little bit, I think that has, for me, opened up the gateways to interacting with the daemon or the genius. And I should probably explain what I mean by second attention, because that probably obscure. So two attentions. The first attention is typically the attention that, for the most part in society, we assume is the only attention. The first attention is that awareness that's linked to the thinking machine, to interpretation, and the automatic assignment of meaning. Okay, so it's an automatic process that you perceive something, you put a label on it, you name it, then you know what it is because you decided it meant this or that, or you labeled it. Okay, that's the first attention. The second attention is that awareness linked to presence, to energy, to phenomena, without any assignment of meaning. So the automatic reflex of assigning meaning to perception is relaxed, and what you're left with is simply the action of seeing, but without interpreting what you're seeing. So it's a very unusual shift from first to second attentions, and yet it can be demystified by, you know, the terms intellect and intuition, or left brain, right brain interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody has moments of second attention coming in, you know, whether you have some surprise moment where they're perceiving something or they have some experience, but they don't know what it means. They don't know what to label it. And they're just in this moment like, oh, my God, that's the second attention. And as soon as they decide, okay, they have to label it or put a name on it, then the first attention kicks in, and then they lose that connection with the second attention of, you know, simple witnessing a phenomena they don't have a label for.
Now, can you give a bit of insight into no form? So this is a form of paratheatrical performance art or meditation maybe that, yeah, gets people into these trance states, if that's the correct terminology, but maybe you can elaborate more.
Oh, yeah. So no form is a term borrowed from Buddhist Zazen meditation. And in the context that I use it in, which I've been using since 1977, so going on almost 40 years in paratheater, is that it's the same principle as Zazen, which is to cultivate a certain intimacy with void, a certain comfort with being nothing, a certain openness to being nobody. And so the process itself involves a certain relaxation of the social persona, a certain disidentification, at least temporarily, from self-images, from thoughts, etc. And the practice of no form, as we use it in paratheater, differs from traditional Buddhist Zazen sitting meditation because we practice it standing. And we practice it standing because we used the process of no form, of cultivating a kind of profound internal receptivity, because what we're doing there is looking to gain more sensitivity, more receptivity to sources of energy in the body itself. Now, these sources can be emotion, they can be instinct, they can be impulses, They can be mysterious forces, things that we are sensing or feeling we don't have a label for yet. But the body is just chock full of treasures in regards to all manner of experience and forces embedded and buried into ourselves as a result of all the memories and experiences that we've had. So we use NoForm simply as a way, as a tool, to gain access to those forces in the body as movement resources. And this is why we practice it in a standing position, because once we gain access to these energies by standing, we are in a position of allowing those forces to engage us into a kind of spontaneous eruption of energies that are excavated in the body, and we're following this through processes of physical theater, dance methods, and vocal technique and vocalization processes. And so right away, it differs from anything in terms of like a Buddhist zazen dictative samadhi, or we're not using NoForm to achieve enlightenment or anything like that. We're just using it as a tool to gain enough receptivity to be moved, physically moved, emotionally moved by forces in the body, so that it becomes more of a creative, physically creative process. And in doing that, the NoForm practice, in essence, becomes a trance induction device. Because, you know, when you're under the influence of energies being unleashed in your body, and you're, you know, allowing those to move you, you enter an altered state. You can't help but undergo a change of state of consciousness. And then after each engagement and immersion and expression of these physical forces, after that process, we always return to the standing NoForm practice to disengage, disidentify with those energies, and to release our attachment to those forces. So we also use the NoForm practice after we engage all these energies as a trance dispersion device. It's used in two ways: to induce a trance and then to break that trance.
It reminds me a bit of an intersection between, say, something like Reich's work on orgone, Gurdjieff's sort of performance art. And funny enough, I just interviewed a Butoh dancer. Her aims and goals are similar in her performance as far as how she's intending it to move her and so on and so forth, and the energy she's releasing in the process. It's just a fascinating approach that is in a lineage of trance-inducing sorts of methodologies and what have you. And it's really a work of art, I would say. In so many ways, we all have our art, and this is yours.
It is. And many of the people that I work with are Butoh practitioners. You know, that there's quite a simpatico or harmony in between paratheaters I'm working at, and, you know, most Butoh practices. Most of the work that we do in paratheater is actually non-performance oriented, and, you know, it's done in private behind closed doors with no audience or audits or anything like that. And then, you know, once in a while, meaning once every 6 or 7 years, when we develop enough clarity and substance of what we're working with to merit public performance, we'll develop a performance vehicle and present that publicly. And I've produced a video document on one of these performances. It's available on DVD now at paratheatrical.com or verticalpool.com, my website. And that video product is called Orphans of Delirium.
You also do a bit of work with astrology, is that correct?
Yeah, astrology is kind of like my day job.
So, yeah, what got you into that, and what has kept you interested in it?
Well, to start out with, I've been at it 35 years, and after 35 years, I can honestly say that I don't believe in astrology. I use it because it works.
Hmm.
It's not really a function of my belief system, it turns out. I've read thousands of charts, and I've met with, you know, as many people, and it's way beyond belief at this point. So I don't have any reason to invest belief in it. It simply seems to work. So the way I got into it at the very beginning was that I received an astrology reading from an intelligent person. And I say that because I kind of hate myself for saying this, but I don't think all astrologers are necessarily intelligent people. There's a lot of different reasons people get into astrology, and I think some of those reasons are, oh gosh, shall I just say it? Yeah, stupid. But I got a reading from a fairly intelligent person, and they mentioned a certain week during a certain month about 6 months ahead of the time that the reading was taking place. And he basically says, well, you know, you may want to lay low during this week. I'm just saying, just lay low. Don't, you know, go out there and do stuff. And I just kind of forgot about it. And 6 months went by, and that week happened, and I totally forgot. And by the way, that week was one of the most disastrous weeks of my entire life, where I was apprehended by the military in Finland, where I was visiting, because I had gone back before the cutoff point for indoctrination into their army. And I was, that particular week is when I had the experience, the shocking experience of being owned by a government and told that my life in California was over and that I had to serve in the military for 2 years now and had to let go of everything else that I knew. And pretty scary event. In fact, it was the very event that catalyzed my writing of Angel Tech, my first book, because it so traumatized me that I felt the only way to kind of get back to my life, back to myself, again, was to go into writing and to start reorganizing the pieces of now my now broken self into a new puzzle or a new way of experiencing myself. So I used the whole trauma event as a creative turning point. Long story short, I escaped and I have not gone back there since. But that's how it began. And then I looked at my astrology reading again, and then I, oh my God, this guy said lay low during that week, and had I laid low, maybe I had would have avoided that. But then again, if I avoided that, I have not written Angel Tech. So,
mm-hmm. Well, that transitions well into the concept of Chapel Perilous, I think.
And oh yeah, yeah.
Maybe we can talk about that subject for just a bit. And I liked in your book, it wasn't just a rehashing of it, but you embellished a bit more and said, well, there's three sort of entry points into this zone or something.
Oh, man. Well, let me ask you, this might be a kind of interesting segue into your own experience. What's your take on Chapel Perilous, or have you had an experience yet where you can say, you know, I could be in Chapel Perilous right now?
Yeah, well, in reading it, I could say I'm definitely in one now in the backdoor sense, which I think is a time of not apathy, but you're just, nothing seems to be happening or something, or something slowed down, and you seem sort of in this circuitous but slow inertia that you can't snap out of. So I would say in reading the book, I incorporated my most recent sort of where I am in life sort of concept to that. But then I noticed the two other entryways. And yeah, I would say for sure, especially over the last year, it's probably I've come into most direct contact with it, or these sorts of shocks, or however you want to think about it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your candor there. For those people unfamiliar with the term Chapel Perilous, it comes to us through the mythology of Arthur and the Round Table of Knights. And Chapel Perilous back then, hundreds of years ago, referred to a place in which King Arthur sent his knights to test them to see if they had the physical, emotional, intellectual, and moral fortitude to survive a night in the Chapel Perilous, where they would confront their deepest fears and dreads and nightmares, and if they were able to come out, you know, intact and not like completely insane or crazed, then they were, let's say, worthy of the Round Table. And in the modern, kind of a contemporary level of it, I first read about it in Robert Anton Wilson's book, The Cosmic Trigger, and also some other books of his too, but that's where I first read about it. And the way I have interpreted it, and I've gone through a number of different ways of relating with this experience, but in essence, a person can tell that they're in Chapel Perilous when they feel as if they are kind of literally between things. And what I mean by between things, this can happen, let's say, you're between relationships. One relationship is collapsed, or you know, you're brokenhearted or whatever, and the next relationship is not in sight, and you're in this in-between relationships. If you're relationship-oriented, like some people are, that place of being in-between can be really quite difficult and fraught with uncertainty and all kinds of, you know, self-destructive thoughts and impulses and so forth. Or let's say you've been evicted suddenly, and you have no way to find the next place where you're going to settle your bones and, you know, make a settlement for yourself. And all of a sudden you're between homes. and you're in that state again of great uncertainty, not knowing, you know, which end is up and which end is down. And, you know, you're walking through a kind of limbo, bardo state of profound uncertainty, not knowing what the hell's going to happen next or, you know, what your fate is going to be. And so this is what I mean. The Buddhists have that term bardo, and they use it more in the traditional sense of where the soul goes between incarnations. You know, the soul, you know, it dies and it leaves the physical body, but it doesn't enter the next incarnation right away. It kind of hangs out in this intermediary zone. And there are a number of different kinds of bardos you can read up in Buddhism, just as there are a number of different ways in which the Chapel Perilous can be experienced. I mentioned Chapel Perilous in both my books, Angel Tech and The Eighth Circuit Brain, in very different ways in both books, reflecting my experience when I wrote Angel Tech when I was in my early 30s, and then when I wrote The Eighth Circuit Brain when I was almost 60 years old when I wrote that. So it reflects quite a bit of experience having gone through these intermediary zones, these bardo limbo states. Now, someone who's been in and out of the chapel enough, I know how to get out of the chapel, and so sometimes I will enter Chapel Perilous intentionally just to shake myself up and put myself into the heebie-jeebies of psychic terror, just to wake up a little bit and throw myself off track, you know, get myself off center. Because I found that sometimes, you know, if I get too centered or too sure of myself or too, you know, dead center, that's a good word for it, dead center, that becomes its own point of stagnation, and I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with stagnation. So when I enter points of stagnation, I basically figure, okay, it's time to visit the chapel. And so I will, you know, enter certain experiences that I know will throw me off track, and I know they're psychologically dangerous and so forth. But at this point in my life, I have enough, let's say, tools or meditation practices and so forth. So I feel confident that I can get back to, you know, some sense of, okay, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, these are my values. But once in a while, I like to get bumped off center. And the thing is that when I was younger, it was a whole different situation because I didn't do it on purpose. all the Chapel Perilous experiences, you know, happened accidentally. And it was usually for me, it was, you know, triggered by falling in love with the wrong women. I say the wrong women, not that there was anything wrong with them. It was just like falling in love with impossible relationships.
So to do a quick 180 here, the platform that I'm operating off is SyncBook Radio, and it's an offshoot of what's called SyncBook Press, which is a small publisher of kind of strange, sometimes occult books. And I know that the first book you published was with Falcon, I think, or maybe it was with another publisher, but you came around to meeting up or hooking up with Falcon Press, which is run by a guy named Christopher Hyatt, or at least that was a pseudonym or something. He's an interesting character, and maybe...
No shit.
Yeah, if you're comfortable talking about your relationship with him, I'd love to just have a bit on that.
Ah, okay. Right. I first published Angel Tech on my own. I did a limited edition of about 1,300 copies, and they just flew off the shelf. I was really lucky to obtain endorsements from both Timothy Leary and Robert Anton Wilson as a complete unknown author, because if I had not those endorsements, I don't know how I would have even sold, you know, 100 books. So I was, in a sense, like, how can I say it, a midget standing on the shoulders of giants. Very grateful for that gift, completely unexpected. I mean, I sent Timothy Leary a letter and a copy of the manuscript with no expectation that he would do anything. And then he sent back the quote, the endorsement, and said, go for it. And I did. And so anyway, after 1,300 sold out pretty quickly, Falcon Press, that caught their attention because I had already done the groundwork of getting it into distribution, and I already done the groundwork of typesetting and everything. So they offered me a joint venture at the very beginning, which was a kind of an unheard of proposal because, you know, I don't know if you know about the book industry enough, but authors, if they get royalties, it was like, what, between 5 and 12%, you know? And that's after, you know, the distribution gets paid off. So, you know, it's practically nothing. And so they said, you know, if you can muster up half of the printing cost, you know, we'll split it 50-50 down the middle. So that's how I started up with Falcon Press. And Christopher S. Hyatt, as a pseudonym for Alan Miller, he was the chief, like the CEO, and him and Nick Tarcher, his business partner, ran Falcon Press. And yeah, in terms of my experience, let's see, between this would have been from 1986 to 1991, I was on fairly close terms with Hyatt, visiting quite often. We wrote a book together called Pregnant Universe. I wrote a book, The Akashic Record Player, that actually featured Hyatt as a character in that book. And we got along really well. He became not just a friend to me, but a mentor. And then we had a falling out, you know, after I had allowed them to publish three of my books, plus Pregnant Universe. I signed up for three books. And then he wanted me to continue on in Falcon Press. At the time, I simply didn't want to do that. I wanted to publish books on my own because I knew I would actually make more money doing that. And I had figured out enough about the publishing business to go ahead on my own. And he didn't really take kindly to that, so we had a little bit of a falling out. You know, that was the end of that friendship, unfortunately. It was a kind of a sad departure. But my experience with him was quite profound in that, you know, as someone who was not raised by a father, I was raised by two women, my mother and grandmother. He became, in a sense, a kind of surrogate father figure in a way, if you can imagine someone who published The Psychopath's Bible as being your dad. So, you know, I came to know him as one of the more compassionate, intelligent, and audacious, and really hilarious individuals I had ever met. And when he passed away on his deathbed, there was an outrageous, fraudulent deathbed signing of his company, Falcon Press, to his biological son, a fraudulent deathbed signing that totally broke up Falcon Press and left Hyatt's long-term business partner, Nick Tarcher, pretty much out in the cold. And Hyatt's biological son, you know, he didn't read Hyatt's book. He was not interested in magic or anything like that. He was a college basketball coach looking to make a lot of money and perhaps liquidate the supply of books or whatever. So it was quite a bit of travesty for those people on the inside, including myself, Nick Tarcher, Hyatt's wife, Linda Miller, too. And I actually reacted. I was enraged by the fraudulent deathbed signing of power off to this biological son. And I made a movie from that, a feature underground film called To Dream of Falling Upwards. And I've been making these underground films now for about 20 years. And they can actually, you know, if people want to check them out, you know, there's clips and pictures and reviews and stuff on verticalpool.com. Check that out. Anyway, the film came out, and Nick Tarcher and Linda Miller got together as business partners, and they formed what's now has become the original Falcon Press. And they're doing quite well. They're picking up the steam, picking up where they left off, and moving forward with a lot of integrity. And this is why I've actually moved all my property, Angel Tech, the Akashic Record Player, away from anything involving, you know, what has become the new Falcon Publications, over to the original Falcon Press. And the original Falcon Press also carries most of my films on DVD as well.
Mm, okay. Well, yeah, no, Falcon Press for me just represents a very interesting intersection between occultism and psychology and science and everywhere in between. It's just a very diverse platform, and I've always appreciated the titles that came from there. And to know the history of these things is always interesting.
Yeah, well, remember now, it's the original Falcon Press that people want to buy the books from. Please boycott new Falcon Publications. That's an official announcement from me. Okay, go on.
Okay. I know you knew Robert Anton Wilson a bit, and I don't know if you got to meet Leary face-to-face or anything like that, but can you provide any commentary on knowing them or having some correspondences with them in the flesh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bob Wilson, I did hang out with him quite a bit between 1979 and about 92. I mean, we were on close terms. I helped produce some of his talks when I lived in Boulder, Colorado. I opened up for him in several of his lectures. I opened up in certain performance vehicles that I did solo work with. So I got to be in Bob's company quite a bit, and this is actually documented in my most recent book, The Eighth Circuit Brain. People can read about that, about how I met Bob and, you know, my time with Bob. Leary, I just met once. Besides getting the mail, the endorsement in the mail from him for my book, Angel Tech, He visited Boulder in the mid-80s on a lecture circuit where he was talking about the eight-circuit brain. And I was invited to a dinner where Leary was the honorary guest. And for some reason, he sat right down beside me. And we engaged a discussion at that point. And I just remember an extraordinary moment. He just kind of, in the middle of talking, he just stopped. And he locked eyes with me. And looking into the eyes of Timothy Leary is something else, because this guy is something. I mean, it's not just that he's taken a lot of LSD, but there's real genius at work there. Anyway, he takes a look at me. He doesn't say a word. And he's just looking at me to make sure that I'm paying attention. Okay, so I'm paying attention. And he recognized, okay, I see you're paying attention. He didn't say that. He just recognized it. And then he said, you know, I like your mind. Wow. So that was okay. That was the moment where I said, okay, I can move forward on this process here, because I just got some kind of blessing from the Pope, you know, of the eight-circuit brain. And that was very cool. To this day, I would say my brief encounter with Tim Leary, I can say just from that brief encounter and that dialogue over the dinner table, he was probably the most intelligent person I've ever met. And I mean that on all levels, intellectually, socially, somatically, I mean, all up and down the eighth circuit. I mean, he was activated on all eight circuits, mm-hmm. and just, you know, really quite a phenomena. And a human being, just funny as hell, and just a delight to be around. And I miss both Tim and Bob.
The final question will be a nerdier question for my sake, because there is a slight difference between the eight circuit models, where there's a shuffling around in the top circuits between 6 and 7. And so you have the neurogenetic circuit and then John Lilly's metaprogramming circuit. So how far can metaprogramming go, I guess, for you? And that seems to be a large narrative of the eight circuits, is the re-imprinting process and engaging this metaprogramming circuit, so to speak. Now, what do you think of that? Because that, you've been talking of kind of a surrendering type of style, but Leary and Wilson would talk about re-imprinting.
Well, when we're talking about John Lilly, we're also talking about someone who championed a disembodied metaphysical bias for most of his life. You know, that he was a connoisseur of ketamine. Do you know about ketamine?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So he was a connoisseur of ketamine and flotation tanks, and the combination of those catapults into out-of-body experience.
Right.
And so this had a profound effect on his thinking and the way he would categorize his experience, as well as, you know, assign various meanings to the eight circuit model and so forth. So I take that into consideration, because my bias is more of a, what I call, embodiment bias. Mm-hmm. I have a more embodiment bias when it comes to consciousness research, metaphysics, mysticism, whatever. You know, I bring my body with me. I don't want to leave it until I really, really have to, if you know what I'm saying. And I'm in no rush for that. And my experience, and this is kind of an esoteric question, so I don't know to what degree the listeners will kind of follow this, but I do follow what you're saying there. And in my experience, that the link between the sixth and seventh circuit, the sixth circuit, in my experience, refers to the central nervous system becoming aware of itself. And so in that process of, okay, a self-aware nervous system, what does that mean? Well, it means a nervous system that is starting to navigate experience as a nervous system, not just the body. So it's at that level where you're not just identified with your body, but you're identified with the nervous system. And to me, the nervous system actually, it acts as a sheath for the energetic body. So the energetic body and the nervous system are linked together. And once you're identified with the energetic body, in a way, it's in a sense, you're identifying with the soul. You're soul identified at that point. You're not body identified. You're identified with the energetic body. And at that level, you open up a whole freedom of navigation and interaction and choice making that opens up a perception of what sometimes I call reality selection, or being able to perceive multiple reality tunnels or perspectives simultaneously without assigning more value to one over another. So it opens up a kind of perception of relativistic experience or perception. So at that level, I think that there's still some kind of self-management available where, you know, you can begin determining and controlling your future and your experience from that point. However, when you get into seventh circuit, we're talking then about non-dual experience. And if you can, in a sense, I mean, one analogy I think Leary introduced, I think is quite intelligent, is the most basic biological unit of intelligence would be the neuron in the nervous system, the neuron with its capacity to absorb, store, and transmit information and/or energy, which is, I think, a pretty good working definition for intelligence itself, mm-hmm. the capacity to absorb, store, or integrate, and transmit information and/or energy. So along those lines, the Seventh Circuit would link to the intelligence of DNA, genetic intelligence. And as you know, anybody that studies anatomy 101 or physics 101 knows that DNA controls the nervous system, and the nervous system controls the physical body. Mm-hmm. And so that there is a kind of a hierarchy of management or control. And what gets really interesting is, well, what manages or controls DNA? And so that now we enter kind of a heuristic area of, you know, what exists in the center of the nucleus of the atom, you know, down into Quark City, you know, down into the mysterious singularity of the heart of the atom. Well, the speculation here is that that is what informs or governs DNA, which then manages nervous systems or even manufactures nervous systems and manages them and then so forth. So to make a long story short, I'm kind of going around circles here a little bit. Once you're engaged at the level of DNA, this is, I think, a really good example of what happened with Hitler, I think. One of my theories is that he tapped into a Seventh Circuit experience somehow and was able, through some kind of hypnotic transmission, trick millions of Germans into believing that their particular gene pool was the superior gene pool. I mean, it was really a transmission from genetic DNA intelligence there that everyone went along with it. But he had identified with it. He had somehow believed that he was the manager. He was the, you know, and, you know, there was a commercial on television years ago, you know, where the tagline of the commercial at the end is that you don't fool Mother Nature. So to say that you can get in there and reprogram from the level of DNA, well, this is partly what's happening, you know, in the world of nanotechnology and cloning and the future of management of genetic material. This is already happening. However, it's a very perilous era. You know, everyone that is deeply in it knows of the potential dangers of messing too much with the course of DNA and mm-hmm. nanotechnology and going into a place of actually trying to control and manage existence from that level. So, you know, I can see that, yeah, it's possible to do metaprogramming from the seventh level, but just for my own purposes, I like to stay in the level six when it comes to self-management. I'm not here to manage the species. And that's what Seventh Circuit is about.
Yeah.
Seventh Circuit is about species intelligence. It's the genetic link. And unless you're into, if you're one of these people that wants to manage the species, then you're going to go right into Seventh Circuit and try to manage from a level of DNA. And I just think it's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. I don't think it will work. And if it works for a little while, I think it will backfire. And I think a classic example of that is what happened with the Third Reich.
So I guess in wrapping up, why don't you give us some sort of idea of newer projects, even though we've been sprinkling those throughout the interview, stuff you're really focusing on, upcoming events, anything you're writing, these sorts of things?
Oh, thank you. Well, it's interesting. My next film is going to have its world premiere in Portland, July 23rd and July 24th. It's called Out of the Woods. And I'm still in post-production with that. I'm still in the editing processes with that. I'm quite excited about that. That explores actually the connections between Seventh Circuit and Third Circuit and Eighth Circuit and Fourth Circuit. I didn't intentionally go about imposing the Eighth Circuit model on it, but in retrospect and looking back, I go, oh my God, this is, you know, about a person coming to terms with a powerful out-of-body experience. In the story, the character has a near-death experience and he returns from a near-death experience with amnesia and this new psychic ability to hear the thoughts of others. And he's trying to piece together some semblance of identity basically from the thoughts of others, what, you know, what others think of him mm-hmm. and all that. So that's new. That's coming up. A book, The Akashic Record Player, a book that just It went out of print. It was in print for about 12 years, and it's been out of print for 15 years, and it's now just this last month has been re-released by the original Falcon Press, and I'm very excited about that. Let's see. My paratheater work is a continuing process here in Berkeley, California, and people interested in that can check it out at paratheatrical.com.
Okay, so Ontario, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, yeah, it's been a pleasure. You asked some really great questions.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.